Shrink Wrap Radio number 779. Jungian psychotherapist, anti-war activist, poet, Edward Tick, PhD, on coming
and now
home
it's time
in Vietnam.
Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio. You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Seeking the most powerful healing practices to address the invisible wounds of war, Dr. Ed Tick has led journeys to Vietnam for veterans, survivors, activists, and pilgrims for the past 20 years. We will discuss his latest book, Coming Home in Vietnam, a moving and revelatory collection documents the people, places, and experiences on these journeys. It illuminates the soul-searching and healing that occurs when Vietnamese women and children and veterans of every faction of the, quote, American War gather together to share storytelling and ritual, grieving and reconciliation and atonement. These poems reveal war's aftermath for Vietnamese and Americans alike, and their return to peace, healing, and belonging in the very land torn by war's horrors. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Edward Tick, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dr. Dave. I'm honored to see you again and be back with you.
Well, I am so honored and excited to have you here. And for our audience, I say welcome back because we previously had a conversation in 2007. And podcast-wise, I was around 109 or number 106. This is going to be number 779.
Wow.
So
well,
I've been busy, too. You've been busy. You've been busy, and I've been busy. And you're doing such you were already doing important work when we spoke 14 years ago. And now that work has expanded to activities that potentially have a global impact. So maybe you can give us a thumbnail sketch of your mission's evolution from back then to now.
Thank you. I will try to keep it thumbnail.
Okay.
First of all, I appreciate all that you're doing in the way almost going on 800 podcasts, the public and professional education you're doing is very important.
Yeah,
so I honor you and thank you for that. And some of us in the mental health field share the conviction that we have to get the wisdom that we've gained out to the general public, not to just keep it in professional closed quarters. And so each of us are doing that in our ways, and I honor you for that and the importance of that.
Thank you.
So, the evolution of my work is related to that as well. We usually talk, most of the attention to my work is on the attention given to my work with the military and veterans. And my new book, which we will be talking about in a few minutes, is about that. So we can announce to our listeners that my brand new book, Coming Home in Vietnam, is literally just published about 10 days ago.
Oh, wow. And I don't have a physical copy, so I've been working from a PDF, so I'm really glad you held it up.
Well, thank you. The COVID and the supply chain breakdown slowed the book down a lot. So I just got my own last weekend. But
okay.
That's other issues that we don't want to spend our beautiful interview time on. All right, so briefly, when we last spoke, my book, War on the Soul, had been out a few years. That came out in 2005. And at that time, and I continue to concentrate on seeking all of the most comprehensive and holistic practices for healing, resolving long-term, chronic, wartime, post-traumatic stress disorder, and moral injury. When we spoke in 2007, moral injury was not even a recognized topic yet.
No.
Or just beginning. But now it is well established, and my work certainly addresses that profoundly and directly. So since we spoke, you know of War on the Soul, and that I have been interpreting our traumatic wound, post-traumatic stress disorder, as I declared in that book, and since not only as the broken brain chemistry that we understand and that our field is dominated by, but also that it is a comprehensive, holistic wound of the body, mind, heart, and soul, and society, and our spirituality. It's really comprehensive and impacts us on all of those dimensions. I presented that in War on the Soul and also stated that we could translate the acronym PTSD to post-traumatic soul distress and post-traumatic social disorder.
Yeah.
So I've continued to work on these wounds, on those dimensions of the soul and of society. We have so many good colleagues in the mental health field working on trying to address trauma, mostly now through healing our broken brain. So I respect all of our colleagues doing that, and I'm looking at our violent and wartime traumas from these other angles of the archetypal spiritual dimensions and the social, historical, cultural dimensions.
Yeah.
All right. So briefly, I have a follow-up book to War on the Soul called Warrior's Return, and that came out in 2014, where I expanded what I presented in War on the Souls to offer a full roadmap home for military and veteran returnees, based not on the American way of doing things, but on worldwide warrior traditions and on using our archetypal models, Joseph Campbell's Heroes model, overlaying it with the military experience.
Right.
So that I actually present a full model of the warrior's heroic journey with the same stages that Campbell described of departure, initiation, and return, and showing all of the stages of the military journey from the civilian through military training and the deconstruction of the civilian identity, plunging people into the military and into their underworld experiences, into their initiatory challenges through military service and combat, if that happens, and then the very difficult homecoming journey, which Campbell rightly said is the most difficult part of the journey, not the descent into hell, because we have to do that in the military anyway with comrades, but returning home, because nobody at home has changed and they want the same person back that they sent off to war in the first place.
Yeah.
And we can't do that. And so this highlights that an inadequate homecoming is also a source of trauma and betrayal to those who are willing to give their lives in service to the rest of us.
Yeah.
So my book, Warrior's Return, fully traces that and presents models and experiences and rituals from other cultures and how to bring them into our culture and our psychological and mental health practices to deliver a full return journey. Like reverse boot camps, how do we give the returned warriors a complete deconstruction? We don't take apart the warrior archetype. That has been awakened forever. But we retune it to positive dimensions of healing and lifelong service, and work to heal the moral injury and the other guilt and pain and stains and grief that the veterans are having.
Let me insert a little biographical insert here that during the Vietnam conflict, do I have it correctly that you were in high school?
College.
You were in college. Okay.
Yes. Well, so it began while I was in high school. I did begin protesting it in high school at the beginning of the war.
Yes.
The hot years were when I was in college. I turned 18 in 1969, the height of the war.
Okay. And 1969, I'm trying to work out my own age. I avoided going to Vietnam by being in graduate school, and so I in a PhD program at that point, and being married, and then having a child. That combined with the fact that I came out of a neighborhood that was in Los Angeles that was consisted mostly of poor blacks, and so I think that probably also helped. You know, if anybody looked at the draft board and said, you know, here's this guy who's on a good educational trajectory, I figured I was probably in good shape. And in fact, I never got called up, although it was definitely a source of anxiety the whole time. And I'm also, I've got stories of a couple of good friends in graduate school who are terrified of being drafted. We're totally against it, you know, morally, psychologically, spiritually, on every level, and determined not to get drafted. So they about drove themselves crazy in the process of preparing not to be drafted. So that's more than I intended to say here, but the other important thing for people to understand is that you were never in the military. You were against from high school. You were against military service and war and all of that. And so your way of serving really has been this lifelong commitment to rescuing, helping those who did go. And so that's a little bit of an aside, but I think it helps.
Well, it's actually, thank you very much. Yeah. And it's not an aside, and let me share why. We both understand and work with the concept of moral injury. And when some of our patients are suffering from it, we do our best to address their deep pain in their hearts and souls, their conscience. Okay. What you just shared is accurate for our entire generation and nation. The Vietnam War itself caused moral injury to the entire generation and the entire nation. Anytime a war is wrong, morally wrong, for money, for empire, for land, for any reasons whatsoever, except we're being attacked and our schools and our children are being bombed and killed, and there's no other choice but self-defense. That's the only time that taking up violence might not lead to moral injury. That's what the Vietnamese tell us, and we can get to that in a few moments.
Yeah.
But over and over and over again in Vietnam, the Vietnamese describe that they do not have moral injury because they were only defending their country.
Right.
They also hate war. They've been invaded for 2,000 years.
Yeah.
Nonstop.
Yeah.
They hate war, and they know it's long-term damage, and they actually profoundly respect America, even during the war
with
them. Which
is remarkable, just remarkable.
Yeah.
That's one of the major learnings of your work and of your taking, going to leap us ahead a little bit, that initially you were working with returning Vietnam vets here in this country, and you were beginning to apply some of the archetypal wisdom some rituals from Native Americans and so on. And and you reported back then that you were having good success. And so somehow that work notched up to your saying, hey, let's go to Vietnam to gather some wounded vets under psychologically and probably physically wounded vets under your wing, so to speak, and to say, well, let's go there and see what we can find out and see if there's any healing there.
Yes. So just to round out my story, you are correct that since I did not have to serve in the military and I was against the war, I embraced this task as a lifelong devotion such that I could give my alternative service in this way. Unlike you, I had student deferment for 1 year when I was a freshman in college. And then if we remember, because the drafts were so it was so controversial, because you're right, they were taking the poor and minority people. So the draft was done away with. And then we had the lottery system, which was even more insane and immoral. Anyway, so I lost my student deferment after 1 year. But then with the lottery system, I got a high number and I didn't have to do anything. And that was insane also, that some of my classmates left the country. Some were off to Vietnam. Some quit school because they had high numbers. And they only wanted to be there for the student deferment.
Yeah. I can't remember the lottery and if I had a high number or not. I may have. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was a moral injury to the generation and the nation as well.
Yeah.
And for me, I was glad I didn't have to be in Vietnam. And I also wanted to give some form of alternative service. I had been applying for my conscientious objector plea, but then I didn't need that either. So I was still thinking, I'm a conscientious objector. I want to give service back. And so I finished my master's degree in psychology in 1975, the year the war ended. And I began practicing in a rural area of central New York State, and veterans started to come into my practice. Others said, they're dangerous and crazy. Don't work with them. But I said, no, they're not. They're our generation. And they're but for fortune. Could have been me. Yeah. Of course I want to work with them and help them come back. And then I awaken to, aha. I had thought if I was forced to go to Vietnam, the only way I could have gone would be as a medic. So now I have a chance to be a home front medic.
Yeah, yeah.
And I embrace that identity as a home front doc, and I've been working to fulfill that to the best of my ability. So
somewhere along the line, because you mentioned Joseph Campbell and so on, and somewhere along the line, it seems like you did some intensive graduate study in Jungian psychology, psychotherapy.
Well, yes. yeah, my master's degree is in psychology, and actually, I was in an alternative master's program, and I stretched my degree. My master's degree, if we declared my major, would have been the psychology of extreme states. So I did intensive studies in war, in all forms of prejudice and oppression. So Holocaust studies and racism studies worldwide, not just American, to see what the oppressions do to the afflicted people, also the creative process and also the archetypal processes. And then my doctorate, I went even broader. My doctorate's actually in communication. So I put psychology, linguistics and communications, and literature and the humanities all together. So I've always had that orientation toward the archetypal and toward including the humanities in our work.
And did you get involved with one of the Jung Institutes or not?
Well, now I am.
Yeah.
Not back then. But now the Jungian community does appreciate my work in the way I'm applying archetypal treatment to some of our most difficult social and historical.
Yeah, needs. I would think so. Were you the person who introduced this concept of moral injury, or was that someone else?
Jonathan Shea gets the credit for that. Jonathan Shea wrote his two well-known books are Achilles in Vietnam and Odysseus in America. Wow. He was a psychiatrist at the Boston VA hospital his entire career. And he coined the term moral injury in those books.
Uh-huh. Yeah, valuable addition.
Yes.
Maybe we should try to get you started on your book. Because I want to make sure I know that, as I say, you've gone back to Vietnam with veterans more than once.
19 times now. I began this practice in the year 2000, which was the 25th anniversary of the end of the war. And I've gone until the pandemic stopped us two Novembers ago. So 19 times from 2000 to 2019. Every trip is 2.5 or 3 weeks long. And I usually stay longer and continue independent research and projects with the Vietnamese there. And I have been researching whether or not PTSD and moral injury exist in Vietnam and in what form. So we have a significant cultural comparison that I'd like to share during this interview as well. And so by now I've spent about a year and a quarter or more of my life in Vietnam. So there too, making up for not serving during the war, I've had more than a year in country.
And I think too, I'm imagining that particularly on that first journey, that it would require considerable courage, like going to war. You're going to meet our nominal enemy, not knowing how you would be received. And you're taking some of the, from their point of view, some of the felons who attack them and you know, in various ways and harmed them. So I think that that was a courageous thing to do, like going to war.
Well, thank you very much. And it felt that way in several ways. One matter is that I think, you know, I also have expertise in ancient Greece and the beginnings of therapy and philosophy back then. I led 5 international journeys to Greece first before I ever went to Vietnam, because I expected Vietnam would be much more difficult and challenging.
Yeah,
I didn't know what we would meet with the Vietnamese. Our veterans were exceedingly anxious about going back. They expected to be met as criminals and felons, that the ghosts were waiting to haunt them. The Vietnamese were waiting to punish them and arrest them. So they really had those fears, and I didn't know the Vietnamese then, so I didn't know what we were going to meet. In addition to that, while I have the psychological and spiritual theory that I'm thinking of the 23rd Psalm. What are the line? You set a table for me in the place of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. I was hoping for that for both sides, but I had no idea. And so I didn't know the Vietnamese, and I didn't know what it would be like theoretically to, it's a form of exposure and immersion therapy, we could say, to go back to where you fought, to the actual battlefields and the people you fought against, and confront them again now, and not imaginally in the therapy room, but real life, face to face.
And for all you knew, the guys that you were taking over there, they might have been arrested. They might have been arrested and jailed and who knows
at first,
what.
Right.
And,
at first.
And they would have been probably legally justified in doing that.
And I'm happy to share with you and audiences that nothing like that has ever happened.
Yeah.
So in 19 journeys back there, so 20 years of journeys, about a year and a half in country, I take a dozen or 15 people each trip. So that's about 300 to 400 Americans. By now, several people have come back with me twice. It is so refreshing and healing and peacemaking. But somewhere around 300 or more Americans, about half were veterans. I've also taken some veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan. They want to be with former foes of Americans, and they want to experience the reconciliation process, but they can't go back to their sandbox wars to do that. So they've wanted to go back to Vietnam. And of course, I bring peace activists. I've brought surviving widows, children, family members.
Wow.
Sometimes veterans are so disabled that they want to go back, but they can't travel anymore. So they send family members in proxy for them.
Wow. And you have felt so embraced by the Vietnamese and in a really mutual, a strong mutuality of embracing them, them embracing you, that the foreword to your book is an expression of gratitude, and you list all of these Vietnamese people who made who've been very helpful in your mission, and some of whom you've formed deep relationships with. I think you have adopted.
Yes. Yeah, I have an adopted goddaughter who comes from a small village in the rural north, about 2 hours outside of Hanoi. And not only have I visited that village and that region, but I've researched many of the villages in the surrounding area, because what they tell us is, well, in many of these villages, including my goddaughter's home village, I'm the first American they've ever met. What they tell us in the north is the only thing we ever met from America before you arrived here to visit with us were the bombs that your planes dropped on us during the war.
Yeah.
And we're so glad you're here. We've been waiting decades for Americans to come and meet us so we can share stories and wow. embrace each other and reconcile.
Wow.
It's extraordinary. My goddaughter, her first name is Nhoc in Vietnamese. It means jade. And her soul and heart are jades. She's wonderful. I met her in 2005 at the 995th anniversary celebration of the founding of Hanoi. She was a college student at the time. Huh. There's several stories worth telling from this. And this shows the degree of reconciliation possible. Okay. I arrived in Hanoi for that anniversary. I went to a literature and arts celebration of this anniversary. There was a panel presentation from the most popular writers from Hanoi at that time to celebrate their renaissance of the arts since the end of the American War. Mm-hmm. So there was a panel with about seven chairs, and all of them but one were filled. I met the president of the Writers Union. We were talking about the event, and I shared why I was there. And, oh, you're the only American here? Well, we're really glad you showed up. So I said, well, where's your other writer? There's an empty chair there. Are we waiting for that writer? He said, no, that chair is for the missing American. You have had so much influence on our history that when we do these kinds of events, we leave a missing American chair. Now, here in the United States, we have the MIA chair. Huh. At many veteran events, we leave an MIA chair and a table setting for those who are missing or those who are fallen who might be part of us. Well, the Vietnamese do that with us. Wow. We're so much a part of them. So my colleague said we had no idea an American writer was going to show up. So please take the seat and talk to us and read to us during this presentation.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I did. And there's two stories to demonstrate the depth of connection that they're seeking and that's possible. One is that after the presentations, there was an hour for the Vietnamese people to meet their favorite writers. Nice. Right. So for a few minutes, nobody came up to the strange American. Uh-huh. But then about 20 or 30 college students came galloping up to me. And this sweet little girl was in the lead with hardly any English, but they asked to interview me for their college newspaper. As it turns out, well, that sweet little girl is now my goddaughter, but they were aching to meet Americans. They asked if we could make some special meetings between their group and our veterans, because they want to know American veterans. They want to know American veterans' stories. They've watched all of our Vietnam movies on the internet. Their most important English language lessons were listening to our 60s music on the internet.
Yeah.
So they walk around singing, "Where Have All the Flowers Gone?" and our old 60s songs. So literally, when we had meetings with our veterans and them, they surrounded our vets in a beautiful circle and held hands, and they sang that song to our veterans with tears streaming down everybody's faces.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. And they, at that time, they formed a friendships association between American war veterans and Vietnamese college students.
Wow.
All right. One more story from that event. One of my poems in this book is called The Song of a Grieving Mother. It's really painful, but it's really true. One time on one of the journeys, one of our veterans said to me, I have a really sensitive question for you, and I don't want to ask it in front of anybody else. So we had a private conversation. He said, you're right, the Vietnamese are very kind, welcoming, forgiving people, and I'm receiving that. But I still think they're subhuman. They're less human than we are. Well, brother, what do you mean? Could you please explain that? He said, well, they really did use their children as living bombs and booby traps sometimes. And nobody who's fully human can do that. I said, I can struggle to help you understand this and make sense of it if you're willing. And so we talked, and then I put it in a poem. The poem is called Song of a Grieving Mother, and it is from told. Should we read this?
Pardon?
Should I read it?
Yeah. Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Okay. To our readers, this is one of the – probably one of the most important and one of the most painful poems in my book. So don't turn away, because there's very beautiful and uplifting poetry here as well. But this also demonstrates the degree of understanding and reconciliation possible, even across cultures and cultures that have completely different ways of life.
Yeah. So this poem is you giving voice to putting your identifying with, putting yourself in the shoes or the sandals of a grieving mother.
Yes. Yes. Actually putting myself, it's written in first person as if I'm the Vietnamese mother.
Yes. Yes.
And at the moment when she's explaining to her daughter why she's sending her off as a weapon.
Ah.
So first person as if I were the mother. And I read it into the Vietnamese, and then I will share with our listeners how the Vietnamese responded to this. All right. Song of a Grieving Mother. Oh, I need to explain one thing. The Vietnamese have a term called Quê Hồng. Quê Hồng. That means about the same as our Native American brothers and sisters term, Metakyawasan, which many people in the alternative spirituality movement know, and studying with the Native Americans. It means we are all related. Everything is one.
Yeah.
So the Vietnamese term means the same thing. Everything is one. There's no division between us. So we love each other. We love our animals. We love our homes. We love our plants. And the Vietnamese are animistic as well as Buddhist. So everything is alive. Everything has spirit.
Mm.
Right. And so I use the term Quê Hồng. And we need to understand this to understand the Vietnamese people and why they do these things.
Yeah.
So Song of a Grieving Mother. And oh, thank you for helping us get these teachings and this wisdom into our psychological understanding. This is non-Western. And you and I and our colleagues can affirm that though some version of PTSD seems to be universal impact, the beliefs and the values of the culture and the context in which it happens is so important that it really changes the way we experience the traumatic event. And from Vietnam, we learn how true this is and that we don't necessarily break down in the same form of PTSD as we have here in the West. Okay, so Song of a Grieving Mother. I love our water buffalo as much as our hut, and our vegetable patch as much as your school. I love our rice paddy as much as my husband, and my father's tomb as much as my sleeping mat. I love your father as much as my son. I love our pig, though we must eat him. I love our starfruit, jackfruit, and mangoes. I love rice, whether grass, seed, or grain. I love you, my daughter, as my mother loved me. No difference between these. This is Quê Hồng, And so, my daughter, you and our country are one and the same. No life without each. And that is why, with a love more than love, I dress you in bombs and kiss you as you leave. I wrote that originally to try to help our veteran understand how the Vietnamese could be extraordinarily loving and humanistic and spiritual and do these acts.
Yeah.
And when I read it at this event, the first time I read it in Vietnam, a woman about my age came up to me trembling and with tears in her eyes and said, "How did you know?" "Well, sister, what do you mean? How did I know?" She said, "You're an American and you're a man and you don't know our culture. How did you know exactly how I feel? How could you put it into words in your language to say exactly what was going on inside me and so many countless Vietnamese women? If we can do this, then peace and healing between our people and for the planet is really possible." And we embraced.
Yeah. Wow. And so let's talk a bit about how you can do that. How is it that you are capable of that, that we are capable of that?
Well, this is in part therapist to therapist, healer to healer, that we both know and affirm that when somebody is carrying terribly painful traumatic wounds, that we need to not over-identify so that we get lost in the wound, but we need not to keep so much distance that we're objectifying and depersonalizing it, that the trauma survivors really need to experience us stepping into the ecology of the wound together with them and understanding it from inside, yeah, not imposing our interpretation from outside.
I think poetry is the perfect vehicle for expressing that.
And yeah. Thank you.
Were you always a poet?
Before I knew I was going to do anything else, yeah, I was writing. I could quote a poem I wrote in sixth grade. It was silly and young, but I began in grade school. And by the time I was 15, I was in an advanced science curriculum in high school. But while I was supposed to be studying college physics, I was scribbling poetry behind my textbook.
Wow.
So back then I said, no matter what else I do in life, I'm going to always write poetry. So I have stayed with it long before I knew I was going to be a therapist.
Okay.
And it's helped me also in my travels through Vietnam. I do keep extensive field notes, you know, for what we're observing psychologically and culturally, but I write my way through the journeys with poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And it helps me stay in my heart, helps me meditate on the spiritual and cultural dimensions that we're seeing, helps me bring ideas together that are not so easy to express prosaically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
my book is, it's a 20-year collection.
Really, 20-year collection.
Yeah. So and it begins with poems that I began my first journey. And so people also can learn so much about Vietnamese culture and history and the way Vietnam has changed since 2000 in the 20 years since the end of the war.
And the title is Coming Home in Vietnam, which could seem kind of paradoxical, right? So tell us about that title.
It's meant to be paradoxical.
Yes.
We would anticipate an American book about warrior healing to be entitled Coming Home from Vietnam. But you and I share, and our colleagues and our veterans know, that they haven't successfully come home. They haven't been brought home. And that we have a woefully inadequate practice of homecoming and healing after military service and war. In Vietnam as well, the Vietnamese say, to our veterans, we know of your suffering in the United States. We know you have this condition called post-traumatic stress disorder, and you've been suffering your whole life. We really don't have it here. We really have only love and respect and honor for you. And since they say these words, since you haven't been able to come home in America, please return to Vietnam and come home here. My goddaughter Nhoc said to me, and then says to our groups, please keep bringing your veterans here so we can heal them with our love.
Yeah.
They have more love and respect and gratitude, and they want to hear the stories of American veterans more than Americans do.
And in some ways, it sounds like for you, this was coming home. I mean, it's genuine, your experience of coming home to people who are full of so much love and forgiveness and spirituality that it feels like maybe the home that you didn't grow up in here.
Very much, yeah. I do feel more loved and embraced by the common people in that culture when they know what we're doing than I do here.
Yeah.
No offense, but seems like no offense. Sorrow for our culture that we are so alienated from each other that we don't sit down and share stories.
Yeah.
Really share stories, and that the different factions of our culture don't sit down to really understand and hear and heal each other. There's a beautiful African proverb that says, "My enemy is someone whose stories I have not yet heard."
Hmm.
So let's sit down together, like from the neighborhood you grew up in. Let's sit down with everybody and share stories and see what we have in common. I do that as a therapist, and it's very natural for me as an activist as well to take our therapeutic principles and step out of the consulting room and use them in community. Here in America, to create talking circles and mutual programs and civilian-veteran dialogues, so people are hearing each other's stories.
Yes.
And developing understanding and compassion. In Vietnam, that's natural because they've been doing it for thousands of years, because it's a communal and a Confucian and a Buddhist culture. So this is the way they live. Whereas we're so individualistic and alienated here that these acts, which should be natural, simple human acts, take great effort and courage, as you said earlier here. But in some other cultures, we can do them rather easily and naturally because it's what that culture is already doing. And let me say another matter. Again, as therapists, we can affirm that the values and attitudes people have going into a traumatic event profoundly shape the way that event impacts them. So two people can be in the same car accident, for example, and one person can walk away just a little shaken up, and the other can be psychologically wrecked from it. Vietnam being a Buddhist and a Confucian culture, Buddhism teaches life is suffering. So trauma isn't wrong. Trauma isn't unfair. Trauma is some of life's inevitable suffering.
Yeah.
And so they have the attitude of inevitability, karma. It happens to everybody through the ages, and the acceptance of suffering and not complaining about the suffering that we've been given, but embracing it as our spiritual path to master and evolve from it. Whereas here we have so much individuality, entitlement, punishment, people's sense of universal and individual justice that we think that traumas are wrong. They shouldn't be happening. Life was unfair to us. How dare it do it to us? There's none of that in the East.
What does the Confucian background add to the mix?
Several matters. One thing is that we know that Vietnam is a communist country, and some people are still angry or mistrustful because of that. So one thing people should know is that they didn't want to be communist. Vietnam was our ally during World War II, fighting the Japanese. At the end of World War II, they thought they were going to be finally be free from being a French colony, but France wanted the colony back. The United States had the choice: support France in taking the colony back or support Vietnam in their independence, so we sided with France. And we paid 90% of the French war. And then when the French failed, then we went back in. So that's one piece.
Confucian.
I'm sorry, right, Confucian. Yes, okay. So Confucianism is communalism. Confucianism teaches that everybody has a place in society, everybody has a proper role, and societies, well-organized societies, are fair and just and give everybody the place and the support and the duties and the roles and responsibilities they need. So Vietnam does that. Nobody is left out. So even Agent Orange victims that are who are profoundly disabled, we see them in public. We see them in stores. We might go into a store and an Agent Orange survivor with no arms is going to be at the cash register using a pencil to hit the keys. Or they're being taught the traditional Vietnamese handicrafts. So they are practicing the arts and maintaining Vietnamese culture.
Wow.
And getting a way to live. And if we understand the philosophies, it was easy and natural for them to go from a 2,000-year-old Confucian culture where everybody is in part of the society, the common wheel, and everybody has their comfortable place to fit into the society. Oh, well, capitalism didn't work here, and we've been abandoned by the West, and they're at war with us. Communism works here because we're Confucian. It's almost the same. Yeah. It's almost the same. It's a profound, complex social organization that includes everybody and gives each person enough to survive. So so they're Buddhist and they're Confucian. So Buddhism gives them the ability to spiritually cope with their traumas without blame or breakdown. Confucianism gives everybody a place to belong in the culture, including former enemies. Because Confucius said, pray for your enemies that all may be well for them and that your enemies may as quickly as possible become your friends. So they do that. And Vietnamese are also animists. They believe everything is alive. Everything in some sense has spirit. And so they're really devoted to their land and to their animals and to their homes and their schools and work very hard to restore those and treat them spiritually as well. And then finally, they also practice what they call ancestor veneration, which also helps them heal from trauma. In the West, it's called ancestor worship, but they don't like the word worship because they don't say the ancestors are gods, but they do say their souls are still alive and they're in the spirit world or in the cycle of reincarnation. So every Vietnamese home, no matter how poor, even the poorest of the poor living under a tarp in the jungle, has an ancestor altar as the most important object they own.
Mm-hmm.
And they keep pictures or mementos of their ancestors going back 100 years, four generations. And they pray for them always. And they put fruit and flowers on the altars. And they believe that their ancestors are still there connected. And so they will talk to their ancestors, of four generations of ancestors, and report on the family and ask for help and support. And they know when they die, they're going to be the next generation on the altar. And then that last one, the fifth generation back, will go off into the spirit world.
Yeah.
They're never forgotten. They're always connected. Our veterans pray at their altars, often over the souls of their people killed in the war.
Yeah.
Sometimes, our veterans are praying with a family right on the battlefield where they fought. And sometimes our veterans will even say, I wonder if I killed your grandfather. So when that's happened, the Vietnamese family will say, you didn't take his life. You brought his soul back to us. We've been waiting for his return and you're here. And we believe that when people harm each other, kind of the soul stick to each other.
Yeah.
And you're bringing the soul back, and we're doing a ceremony welcoming grandpa back. And from now on and forevermore, you are also our God grandfather. You're a member of this family because you've brought him back to us.
Wow. Now,
David, one more about that. One more.
Yeah.
Some veterans who've been through this ceremony in Vietnam and some veterans here in the States who won't go back, but who have been plagued by nightmares of the dead, have given me war souvenirs, artifacts that they took off dead bodies and said, take it back. It doesn't belong to me. And maybe the Vietnamese are right. Maybe the souls came back with me.
Yeah.
So I've brought back artifacts to Vietnam, sometimes been able to return them to the villages where they were taken from or to at least the war museum so it could be returned to veterans and treated honorifically. Back in the States, the veterans have told me when we've done that, their nightmares ended.
Yeah.
Oh, Chick, what did you do in Vietnam? I haven't had a nightmare since you were there. And this is months later, and they're not coming back. Wow. This must be true that somehow, whether it's psychologically that we wish it or spiritually that it really happens, it works when we're working with archetypal imagery and putting it back in its home with the human souls that it belongs to. It profoundly resolves our deep moral and spiritual conflict.
It makes sense, you know, at some kind of deep level.
Yeah.
As a little footnote, I was intrigued by your mention of Agent Orange, where that is kind of incorporated into their society and where veterans here had difficulty having anybody listen to them and credit them as suffering from Agent Orange. And then later in what you refer to as the Sandbox Wars, something very similar is going on.
Right. Yes, we've got depleted uranium and white phosphorus and other hideous chemicals and poisons that are being used now and causing severe ongoing health crises in those regions, just like Agent Orange. Agent Orange is still a big problem in Vietnam. It's the one and only problem remaining from the war that the Vietnamese are really imploring for help from us. And also, let's include our veterans. American veterans are suffering from Agent Orange disabilities as well. Many have died or have significant diseases, and it does go through the generations. So children and grandchildren of veterans.
That's the part I was wondering about. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. If we have enough time, I have two really short Agent Orange poems to demonstrate this.
Yeah. I wanted to encourage you to read some more poems and, I don't even know how far in we are, but we can.
I haven't been watching either, my friend. This is all too compelling. I'm sorry, it's a fat book, so I'm not finding it quickly. Ah, here's one. Okay. Well, this is Vietnamese woman's testimony, and it's just five lines. It's very simple, but to the point. Though I have two grown children, I have never heard that single word that drips like honey on the heart. Mother. That's one. So the Agent Orange disabilities can be very, very, very severe there. But here's another one, and this is the Confucian perspective. Now, this is in my voice. This was fairly recently, and I was on a cane. So the first line is, this year I walk on three legs. I have a back disability, and so I was walking on three legs that year. But this is called Chung, and it's a short poem devoted to the singer of a band that was called the Agent Orange Victims Band. All adults in their 20s and 30s, all born with severe disabilities. This lead singer was in a wheelchair and Scout's Honor. He was about two feet tall. Full-grown man in his late 20s who will never grow that bigger. And he can sing, but he can't think and make sentences. And everybody in the band had a severe disability. Their pianist was born with no eyes. His face was flat down to his nose, but he learned to play the piano magnificently by ear. So, Agent Orange, Chung, for their lead singer. This year, I walk on three legs, but your legs are stumps and you cannot stand. My ears never stop ringing, but you cannot hear. My eyes are cloudy and squinting. Your face is smooth and empty where eyes should be. I cannot speak your language. You have none. But your voice, your song, the wind that blows through you resounds from your tiny twisted body, a great bronze prayer bell pealing dawn into our darkened world.
Hmm. Yeah.
Magnificent.
Yes. Now, I want to let people know that since we're in the season of giving, that this book that you've written, this book of poetry, would make a wonderful gift for anybody in your life who is soulful and has a sense of depth. This will meet them at a really deep level, and they will appreciate it, I think.
Thank you very much. I second that.
Right.
Let's let our readers know that you don't have to have a personal connection to Vietnam or the Vietnam War to find value in this. There are so many wise and loving testimonies of human stories of healing and reconciliation.
Right.
And making friendship and real deep relations after pain and suffering.
Yeah.
It shows we can turn the negative into the positive. It shows that there is growth and transformation after trauma and pain and suffering. It teaches profound lessons about this culture that is so different from ours and really united in communalism and love and respect for each other. And it shows, as you said earlier when we opened, it really does have international implications, that we can heal post-traumatic stress disorder with much more comprehensive and loving practices. And we can make peace after war, and former foes can become profoundly respectful and loving friends afterwards. And this strange thing about karma. Well, the Vietnamese, our veterans, we very often meet with Buddhist monks and nuns, and we pray in their pagodas. And they're always very welcoming and really loving. So when our veterans will say to a Buddhist monk, "I'm sorry, I did terrible things during the war. I feel so bad." The monks will just smile and hug them and put prayer beads over their head and say, "Oh, my brother, if you feel like you made bad karma during the war 40 or 50 years ago, then all you have to do is make good karma now."
Yeah.
So here or at home, yeah, just make good karma and love everybody and you'll be fine. They teach that the answers to our suffering are much easier if we have courage, if we open our hearts and minds and we have courage to walk in and not fear punishment, because actually we're punishing ourselves for what we
yes.
did. It's not coming from the other.
Yeah.
And really, these people are only waiting to meet us and share stories and heal together with love and generosity. So it's a world model. And if we could,
really, what a gift that they exist on this
yes.
planet to provide us with this teaching and with a real sort of concrete, this is the best of Buddhism in action.
Yes.
You know, it can feel like a nice, pretty story and so on, but to where the rubber meets the road, these people are really living these insights.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I feel really touched just by the sharing that you've done with us here today. And
thank you.
Yeah, so good to spend some time with you again. I really want to thank you for being my guest again on Shrink Wrap Radio. And hopefully we won't wait 14 years, but somewhere down the line, maybe we'll have a chance to speak again.
Oh, my friend, if we have 14 years left, then that's a blessing, but give us the health and strength to do it.
Yeah, really.
I hope to see you before another 14 years passes. Thank you.
What a delight it was to speak again with Dr. Edward Tick after our initial conversation 14 years ago. He told me he actually remembers our initial interview, which impresses me and feels very confirming as well. As you will have heard in today's interview, his very special soul-restoring work over the past 20 years has included taking groups of veterans suffering from PTSD to Vietnam. He's been an anti-war peace activist going back as far as his high school days. He participated in protests during his college years. He had planned to apply for conscientious objector status, but by that time the draft had switched to a lottery basis. He says his lottery number was so high that it seemed pointless to go ahead and apply for the conscientious objector status. At the same time, with other young men his age and younger, sacrificing their lives, whether by choice or by governmental compulsion, he felt morally compelled to do his part. For him, this became his life's work, to serve the wounded warriors. As a holistic therapist, he was strongly influenced by Joseph Campbell's Journey of the Hero model. Ed Tick went on to help our physically, psychologically, and spiritually wounded warriors to reframe their wartime experiences as a hero's journey, to view themselves in reference to the warrior archetype, to see themselves as part of an ancient lineage of service to their community and to higher values. He came to see these veterans as suffering from something deeper than PTSD, which has been explicated as moral injury. In the course of our discussion, I found my mind wandering back to early undergraduate days at the University of Pennsylvania. I've forgotten the exact details, but I believe I was approached by a young man on the street who said he needed a place to spend the night. I don't recall if he was in uniform or not, but he explained that he had been drafted into the military and got through boot camp in another part of the country. On the day I met him, his plan was to go the next day to a military outpost and declare his determination to quit the service. He expected he would be court-martialed and sent to a federal prison. He was a very clean-cut young man, and I had no reason to doubt his story. I felt sad for him and wanted to help. I was able to locate an empty room for him in the dorms. This was sub rosa on my part, in disregard of university housing regulations. I couldn't believe his courage. Somehow, I don't think we exchanged any information that would have allowed us to stay in contact. Since I was majoring in creative writing at that time, I ended up writing a story about that experience. I was in a bit of a fog myself during those years, and this was a weird passing experience in my own miasma. Ed's latest book, Coming Home in Vietnam, is mostly poetry and artful illustrations. There's a beautifully written introductory chapter to orient the reader to what's to come. I'd like to share some brief excerpts from that introductory chapter to give you a sense of Ed's writing. Parenthetically, I will tell you that these references here to Ed are touching me in a tender place. My biological father, whom I did not grow up with, and searched for and eventually found, was also named Ed. Anyway, Dr. Ed Tick writes of his own war service, and I quote, I have been welcomed by veterans into their brotherhood, for I've been drenched in that war, its stories and suffering, its hardships and blessings, its tears of grief and relief for over 40 years now. A friend said to me recently, "Imagine what your life would have been like if you had gone to Vietnam." The irony, protesting that war and hating its pain, lies, betrayal, and duplicity, I have served its aftermath my entire adult life, and that service has transformed me into a military and war trauma specialist. I've been serving every American generation and war since. Close quote. Ed goes on to write vividly about his commitment. Quote, "My passion and commitment that had once been directed in youthful protest against that war became my passionate commitment to heal our veterans and their families and restore a healthy warrior archetype that protects and preserves but does not destroy. The protest movement insisted that our country, quote, bring the boys back home. After the war, it was painfully clear they were not boys and they were not brought home. In my heart and soul, I accepted responsibility for our country's moral injury that was not personally mine and for bringing the women and men whose actions I protested all the way home." Close quote. Ed goes on to explain that he found the confines of a therapy office were not up to the immensity of the task. Quote, "There's so much about war trauma that cannot be accessed in the consultation room. Some veterans continued to fear, hate, and misjudge the Vietnamese. Some declared that they had been on the wrong side and they wished they had fought with them. Most carried what we now call moral injury, the deep wound of having done, participated in, witnessed, or just supported from a distance what they judged to be ultimately wrong. Socrates taught that the soul is wounded by wrongdoing. It was not merely their altered brain chemistry, it was their souls that ached to the depths, and no matter how expert the office therapy, could only be taken so far in their homecoming and healing while remaining divorced from our mainstream society at home and the people they felt we had wronged. In their minds, their nightmares, their energies and behaviors, the war was still raging, the jungles and villages still burning." Close quote. Ed's encounters with the Vietnamese people were healing for him, as well as the American veterans who traveled with him. He writes, quote, "Encountering the Vietnamese land and people, learning who they truly are, seeing the land recovering, and meeting the people decades after the bombs stop falling might give us a chance to end the wars within. When I began heading the first of my healing and reconciliation journeys to Vietnam in 2000, I knew little about the Vietnamese people, land, culture, history, or spirituality, but I needed to know these people and how they endured and finally triumphed. And I needed to discover whether reconciliation was possible and could end the inner wars torturing our survivors." Close quote. Ed found the Vietnamese so welcoming that he had a strong sense of acceptance that could only be described as a sense of homecoming, and thus the title of his book, Coming Home in Vietnam. He writes, and I quote, "Now more than 20 years after my first annual journey, I've spent more than my year in country and become intimate, initiated, and included with the Vietnamese as with my closest, dearest family relations. We have indeed become family. Among our veterans who have returned, most say that their PTSD is no more." Close quote. Dr. Ed Tick tells us that he began writing poetry as a youth. He rightly says poetry is the language of the soul, so it's inevitable and perfect that this book that I've been quoting from is largely poetry. I planned that our interview would consist mostly of him reading his poems. We ended up letting the conversation go where it wanted in the moment. It turned out that he shared only a couple of his poems with us. Particularly powerful was Song of a Grieving Mother, which speaks to how a loving mother can send her daughter off to be a suicide bomber. I hope Ed won't mind my sharing it here again. And his poem reads, "I love our water buffalo as much as our hut, and our vegetable patch as much as your school. I love our rice paddy as much as my husband, and my father's tomb as much as my sleeping mat. I love your father as much as our son. I love our pig, though we must eat him. I love our star fruit, jackfruit, and mangoes. I love rice, whether grass, seed, or grain. I love you, my daughter, as my mother loved me. No difference between these. This is Kwe Hong. And so, my daughter, you and our country are one the same, no life without each. And that is why, with a love more than love, I dress you in bombs and kiss you as you leave." And we need to take a breath and just let that settle for a moment. I feel blessed to have been able to spend this time with Dr. Edward Tick, both in his book and in his person. He's modeled for us, therapists and non-therapists alike, the power of deep listening, compassionate identification, the ability to vividly imagine walking in another's sandals, and humility. During this season of giving, I hope you will give yourself and soulful significant others in your life coming home in Vietnam. Urge your local bookseller to carry it, and of course, it's also available on Amazon.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Selena Mitchell. I'm a licensed acupuncturist in Fresno, California, and a student of psychology, and an avid listener of your program. I wanted to let you know that your programs have regularly inspired me and have ever since I began listening to them a year ago. Thank you for all the thought and hard work that you've put into your excellent podcasts, and I look forward to listening more in the future. Recently, I realized how often I access your podcasts and look at your website and have decided to make a donation in the hopes that you can keep doing what you do for many more years to come. I plan to make more donations in the future as I become available to the funds. I encourage other listeners to do the same. Dr. Dave's programs are an excellent resource and are exposing us to nuances within the field of psychology that would otherwise be hard to come by, and it's so readily and easily accessible in this format. So thanks again, Dr. Dave, and I look forward to listening in the years to come. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Selena Mitchell, for your support. Once again, as I review the honor roll in putting together today's podcast, I'm so appreciative of all you monthly donors. In fact, I'd like to read out the names of the donors who have landed on our site in the last several days. And they are Hank Smith, Asher Hartman, Penny McKenna, Thomas V. Cliff, Robert Kenora, and Connections Counseling. And of course, thank you to all you other monthly supporters. And aside from becoming a monthly donor, you can help by evangelizing Shrinkwrap Radio to your friends, family, and colleagues. Time to shrinkwrap it up. Thanks to my return guest, Dr. Edward Tick, for sharing his incredible journey on a life of service in anti-war activism and healing, and his remarkable book, Coming Home in Vietnam. Next week, my guest will be UK therapist Jerry Hyde on making your demons work for you without selling your soul. Jerry is known for being radically unconventional, so I hope you'll join us then to find out what I'm talking about. So until then, this is Dr. Dave reminding you to be kind to yourselves and others.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.